Hello, and welcome to the Nutrition and Life Podcast. This is where we look at various nutrition and fitness-related topics through the lens of application. We want to give you practical takeaways so that you can create your healthiest, best self backed by knowledge. Now, on to the episode with your host, Coach Lisa.
Hello, and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life Podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking once again with Calvin Scheller. He is the author of a recent article in the Ellen Aragon Research Review about thyroid health. We've had him on a few weeks ago speaking about insulin resistance, so I'm super excited to get into this week's topic. Calvin, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad to talk about it.
Awesome. Well, I would love for you to explain what made you want to write about the thyroid. I mean, it's such a complex topic and so much hype around it also. So please share with us how that came about.
Yeah, well, I'll say my kind of interest in the thyroid started when I was a little bit younger. So I kind of got to talk about my backstory a little bit on the last podcast, but one of the big things that I suffered with was a lot of weight loss and a lot of malabsorption issues. And with this came along with a lot of different, hormonal imbalances, I guess would be the best word for it. But, and one of these was I did have really odd thyroid markers. So I always, after getting my blood work back, I always came back with what could be referred to as subclinical hypothyroidism, essentially having, somewhat normal TSH, but it was on the higher side. So a lot of doctors will only test your TSH, which is short for thyroid stimulating hormone. That's essentially the signal your thyroid is providing you with, the signal that is coming to your thyroid to stimulate the production of the thyroid hormone. And an elevated TSH indicates that your brain is signaling that you want more thyroid hormone production. But a normal TSH would indicate that regardless of your thyroid levels, your body is kind of happy with where its thyroid levels are at. And I always came back with kind of elevated TSH, but not crazy elevated, not out of the reference range. However, I had most of the symptoms of hypothyroidism, and a lot of the other blood markers that I did have tested at the time also indicated I had some degree of hypothyroidism. And then I just asked my doctor if, I told him what I thought was going on, some of the symptoms, and kind of correlated some of the other blood markers and asked if we could get a T3 test done. So directly measuring the thyroid hormone. And when that came back, it was quite low. So naturally, I was prescribed to take a thyroid medication. I took it for a short period of time, but as I started to get things back on track and recover a little bit better, I decided to kind of tackle it naturally with just increasing my consumption of those thyroid stimulating nutrients. So things like iodine, selenium, and many other antioxidants, as well as specifically focusing on my iodine intake, as well as my omega-3 intake, things like that. And today I still suffer a little bit just because I'm at a lower body weight. I still have some of the symptoms, but it's not nearly as bad as it was. At one point I was wearing, sweatshirts in the summer and it was still kind of cold. My hands were still cold. So it did get quite bad at one point, and just been gradually building it back up for a while. But I will say that when you really dive into the literature on the thyroid, it can get very complex and very confusing. A lot of times it's a lot of correlational work. So drawing correlations between hypo and hyperthyroidism and how that might manifest on blood work and physical signs and symptoms, rather than there isn't as much direct evidence as to this causes this, if that makes any sense, but a lot of more correlational work that down the line and continually it will lead into understanding the mechanisms a little bit better.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing a little bit of a personal background there as well. And I think you did a really great job in your article in the paper, making it understandable, although it is such a difficult topic, but kind of going over a similar introduction as you did have in the article, why it would be great if you could explain to us what exactly is the thyroid on you. And you already alluded to the fact that it is very much linked to metabolic health and everything else, but yeah, maybe you can explain what exactly it is that it does in the body.
Yeah, so the thyroid is, I think the best way it's described is a butterfly-shaped gland at the root of your neck, kind of right where your Adam's apple would typically sit. And it produces two main hormones. It produces T4 and T3. The only difference between T4 and T3 is a single iodine. So T3 has three iodine molecules and T4 has four. The active form, which is the one that can actually, as we'll might be able to discuss, will bind to a specific protein inside of your cells and cause all of the downstream signaling, is T3. But interestingly, your thyroid gland actually produces about 90% in the form of T4 and only about 10% in the form of T3. So your thyroid gland produces a lot of T4, but not much T3. But we did get kind of lucky because almost all of our cells, especially the ones that actually respond to the thyroid stimulation, is they have a specific protein or a specific enzyme called the deiodinase enzyme. And it really does kind of what it sounds like. It simply removes an iodine from T4, converting it into T3. So most of the tissues have the ability to convert the inactive form of T4 into T3. If you have high T4 on blood work, but low T3, that's an indication that there may be something just functioning improperly, or there may quite honestly be a reason that your tissues do not want the active thyroid hormone kind of stimulating them. So that's one thing that doesn't pop up much, but it's always, plausible. But the stimulation of, so I guess we can start in the brain. So it's called the HPT axis, the hypothalamus pituitary thyroid axis. So the hypothalamus will produce an initial protein called TRH, and then TRH can then bind to the pituitary gland, which stimulates the pituitary gland to release TSH. That's kind of like a feedback mechanism. And then TSH can then bind to your thyroid, and that stimulates the production of T4 and T3. One thing that people may have heard before is that the production of the thyroid hormones relies a lot on iodine, because iodine is one of the backbones of that molecule, as well as an amino acid, tyrosine. Luckily, we don't see many tyrosine deficiencies, so that's not something that most people have to worry about, especially those who are health conscious, likely have a higher protein intake. But having an iodine deficiency definitely is plausible. It's very difficult to get iodine in for some people because it's found very concentrated, mostly in sea vegetables and in seafood. But the government so kindly began iodizing salt a while back. So essentially just putting iodine into our salt supply because, we know that most people are going to be consuming a fairly high concentration of salt. So the same way that we would enrich bread and other flours with micronutrients, we decided to start enriching salt with iodine. So that pathway does rely on adequate micronutrients, as well as one thing that people don't often think about is antioxidants. So the actual production of the thyroid hormones is best considered kind of an inflammatory process. Within the thyroid gland, we actually produce hydrogen peroxide, which can be subsequently neutralized by antioxidants. And the main antioxidant within the thyroid gland is selenium. So having low selenium can actually predispose us to damage to the thyroid gland, which would ultimately predispose us to things like thyroid cancer or to thyroid autoimmune diseases. So having the adequate amount of antioxidants, especially selenium, within the thyroid gland is important for just maintaining a healthy thyroid gland and allowing it to continue to produce that active thyroid hormone.
Awesome. Yeah, I have to admit that I did not know about TRH prior to reading your article. And I think you explained it so nicely also that it all sort of starts off with our hypothalamus. So in our brain, obviously, and that the brain is always trying to maintain homeostasis when it comes to body temperature, metabolic rate, and all of that, and how that essentially triggers this kind of cascade. So yeah, thank you for explaining that. And I think a quote that you had in there also was thyroid hormones affect almost every cell in the body. And I think that is so important for people to hear, because often we think, oh, you know, it was a little bit low there, that this and that marker, or haven't had any blood markers taken in a year or two or whatever, but I'm struggling with weight loss, or I'm constantly cold, or like all these kind of things. And we don't necessarily think about, hey, let's have our thyroid checked again. And then sometimes it's just TSH that is being checked. And while that seems to be a good marker, or quite indicative of the other hormone production, still, I do think it's great to have a bit more of a complete picture. But yeah, maybe you can explain, like in your instance, for example, why you said you were feeling cold all the time. So what was not functioning in your case so that you were feeling cold, even though it was 100 degrees outside? Or on the other hand, if someone is has hyperthyroidism or hypothyroidism, why are they always feeling hot?
Yeah, so there's two main reasons that the thyroid hormone will increase body temperature. So the first is that just in general, the thyroid hormones will stimulate our metabolic rate. So it essentially stimulates our tissues, specifically the fat tissue, to begin breaking down fat and begin producing energy. And this process produces a minor amount of body temperature, or sorry, a minor amount of heat, which can help maintain our average body temperature. But the other thing that the thyroid hormones do quite potently are they increase the production of what's called uncoupling protein. So an uncoupling protein is just a small protein that sits inside of our mitochondria. That's where our energy is inevitably produced. And essentially what this protein does is it wastes energy in the form of heat. So as many people might know, when we're producing energy a lot of times, when we are producing energy, it requires essentially this assembly line of specific electrons as well as hydrogen. And when these hydrogen molecules are essentially released out of that electron transport chain, the chain in the mitochondria that's producing energy, that actually causes a bit of a heat reaction. So this is a part of our body temperature. It's just maintaining body temperature. So this process of uncoupling, essentially, instead of using these hydrogens to power the production of ATP, these hydrogens are just released into that. So the best word for it is they're wasted. And again, naturally, this is something that can help maintain our body temperature. But in excess, it causes a very high body temperature. So if we have so much of this uncoupling protein inside of our mitochondria, we would essentially just be wasting energy, which is why a lot of times people with hyperthyroidism experience weight loss or the inability to gain weight, because instead of turning a lot of their energy into ATP, sorry, a lot of their macronutrients into ATP, they are essentially just emitting it into the environment and wasting it. So they're going to be hot, but they're also going to have to burn more fat, more glucose, more amino acids in order to maintain the same supply of ATP within all of their cells.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you for explaining it that way. And you mentioned protein a few times, which brought me to another thing that you briefly touched on in the paper, and that was protein turnover. So I guess kind of like unrelated to this point, well, kind of related, but not directly. I think that you explained it so nicely. And again, this is an underrated piece of knowledge, in my opinion, that the body is in a constant flux of anabolism and catabolism. So essentially, like constantly our body is either breaking down muscle tissue or building it up. I think sometimes we think, oh, we just work out, and then maybe the day after we're building up the muscle, and then that's kind of it, and we're just maintaining. Or you know, of course, if we're fasting for a really long amount of time or in a calorie deficit, then we're starting to break things down. But that's really not the way that it works, from my understanding. And maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit more from what you wrote in your paper.
Yes, ma'am. So the thyroid hormones stimulate what we can just call protein turnover. So this is essentially the balance between protein degradation and protein synthesis. So high protein turnover means that there is simultaneously high synthesis and high degradation. So that would be a high rate of protein turnover, meaning we are essentially breaking down and building up multiple proteins at one time. So the thyroid hormone can regulate this. So inside the skeletal muscle, it can stimulate both protein degradation and protein synthesis. There are a myriad of other anabolic or catabolic signals inside the body. So things that can also stimulate either an increase in net protein synthesis or an increase in net protein degradation. And it's the balance of all of these signals that inevitably go into whether or not we are accumulating or losing muscle in a given day or a given period of time. And now, one of the things that the thyroid hormone does in when it's extremely elevated is it can kind of tip that balance towards excessive protein degradation. So people who, and again, there are a number of other anabolic factors that can also signal within the skeletal muscle to allow people with hyperthyroidism to build muscle still if they're resistance training, consuming protein, have higher androgen levels, things like that. But in the grand scheme of things, it will increase one's risk of losing muscle, and you more likely would be less, and you're less likely to put on as much muscle as you possibly could. Conversely, in a state of hypothyroidism, we're also, again, because it stimulates protein turnover, we're decreasing the net amount of protein synthesis as well. So people with hyperthyroidism will still have high rates of protein synthesis, but they're essentially breaking it down just as fast as they're building it up. People with hypothyroidism just aren't building it up or breaking it down. And this can actually lead to kind of dysfunctional muscles in a sense. So it might actually decrease someone's power output and things like that, because this process of protein turnover allows our skeletal muscles to essentially reconfigure themselves to promote more muscle mass and the ability to produce force. So without adequate thyroid hormone stimulation, our muscles, the ability to essentially reconfigure our muscles to get stronger and the ability to just grow muscles is diminished slightly. Again, there's so many other factors that contribute to net protein synthesis or protein degradation that the thyroid hormone, having a high or a low thyroid, the muscular symptoms are less likely. They're just less apparent because the thyroid's main action isn't necessarily on the muscles, but it's definitely kind of, you could think of it as a secondary thing, a secondary sign that you may have thyroid issues. You know, if you're alongside being very hot or being very cold, as well as having, you know, oddness in your muscularity, ability to put on muscle, or even your strength kind of declining, or muscular dysfunction, that could be a sign of hyper or hypothyroidism.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think even though it is, you know, a side component or not the main component of why we might not be able to put on muscle or things like that, I still think it's important to keep that in mind there as well. The next thing I want to touch on is cholesterol, which doesn't at first seem linked to the thyroid health to me. Like if I'm just hearing, you know, in layman's term, oh, like why would we be talking about cholesterol metabolism? But yeah, how does that fit in with thyroid health?
Yeah, so there's a few things that the thyroid does to our cholesterol. It's kind of fascinating. So one thing, so when we have low thyroid hormones, we are less likely to uptake and utilize fat. So fat is transported all throughout our body on a specific molecule called LDL. Specifically, very low density LDL are the most triglyceride rich lipoprotein. And these will essentially go to things like our muscles, and they will release these fatty acids, and the muscles will subsequently take them up and begin to utilize the fatty acids. So if we have low thyroid hormones, the specific enzyme that removes fatty acids from our VLDL, its function is low. So we may actually have a buildup of VLDL in our system just because we simply aren't utilizing it, so it's staying in our system longer. But VLDL has what's considered to be a short half-life. So it doesn't stick around in the body very long. Only, I believe the number, don't quote me on this, I believe it's in the matter of hours. But LDL, so when we remove the triglycerides from a VLDL molecule, this is converted subsequently into what we now call an LDL. There all is also, I'll just mention what's called an IDL or intermediate density lipoprotein. It's essentially when you remove some of the fat from VLDL, but not enough to convert it all the way into the density that is categorized as an LDL. So it goes VLDL, IDL, LDL. But for this discussion, we could think more about just VLDL and LDL. So when we have an increased circulation of these lipoproteins, typically this will show up as an elevated LDL, just because they have such a much longer half-life. And this is actually one of the driving factors behind, if your audience is familiar with the new lean mass hyperresponder kind of popularity, these individuals have a very rapid turnover of these VLDL, which leads to high LDL cholesterol because they're essentially biomarkers for high VLDL turnover or high amounts of fat being circulated to your tissues. But in this scenario, it's simply just high amounts of fat being circulated around the body, but our body not doing much with this fat. And the second thing that it does is it will increase the number and the function of the LDL receptor. So within the liver, we have an LDL receptor that can take LDL out of the bloodstream and recycle it. This could be to use the cholesterol for a secondary purpose or to simply just resynthesize VLDL. But what the thyroid hormones do is they stimulate the uptake of this LDL at the liver. So if we have low thyroid hormones, this leaves more LDL in our circulation. And similarly, we can also uptake LDL in the testes and in the ovaries, and we can use this the cholesterol found in this LDL to actually stimulate the production of different sex hormones, so progesterone, estrogen, testosterone. So by decreasing the amount of these LDL being uptaken by the liver and by the ovaries and testes, we essentially increase the amount that's just left in our bloodstream without a use, without a home almost. So this would more likely be considered more atherogenic than someone in the lean mass hyperresponder category. And the only reason is because these LDL are staying inside of our circulation for much longer. And they're not being properly recycled and reutilized. And when they, the longer they stay inside of circulation, the more likely they are to either go through a process called transcytosis, where they essentially are taken out of the bloodstream and emitted into the other side of the endothelial wall, which is where they can begin to accumulate. They can also, they're more likely to oxidize the longer they stay in the bloodstream. And this oxidized LDL does appear to be more damaging. While normal LDL does still have an atherosclerotic burden or risk, oxidized LDL appears to have a slightly larger risk. So essentially, we are just not utilizing this LDL as much. And the other thing it does is it decreases the amount of the HDL receptors that we have inside of our liver. So we see, interestingly, we see in hypothyroidism an increase in both LDL and HDL, whereas in most scenarios, HDL is oftentimes correlated with metabolic health. So an LDL is typically correlated with poor metabolic health. So most scenarios of high LDL also come with a concomitant low HDL level. However, in hypothyroidism, why I think this marker is such a good marker for hypothyroidism is we see an increase in LDL and HDL simply just because we're not using LDL or HDL properly, if that makes sense. But we will probably also see high triglycerides in this scenario as well, which is again something that we would see in a poor state of health. So it's really this HDL that is the main determinant of someone that may or may not have hypothyroidism if it correlates with other blood markers. For me personally, that was the big blood marker that I saw. I think I had an HDL of about 100, which is quite high. I believe the reference range is greater than 40, and they don't really delineate above that because it is thought, well, it's kind of argued that HDL as high as possible is beneficial. There's more data coming out now indicating that at extremely high levels of HDL, HDL can become atherogenic. So it can actually increase our susceptibility to cardiovascular disease when it's extremely high. But between the range of about 40 to 70, that's typically a very healthy HDL. And it may be doing reverse cholesterol transport, where it's removing cholesterol from the arterial wall. But in hyperthyroidism, so having too high, we would also see a decrease in LDL and a decrease in HDL, which again isn't typical. If we see low LDL, a lot of times we see high HDL, unless someone's using a statin medication or another cholesterol recycling medication or cholesterol absorption blocker. But in healthy people, we typically delineate these people as having low LDL, higher HDL, and low triglycerides. But this kind of concomitant rise and fall in LDL and HDL can help people delineate between health, ill health, and then a thyroid disorder.
Super, super interesting and very nicely explained. I think just another thing to put on the list, thyroid health, not just important for metabolism, not just important for our muscle mass and accumulation, but also cholesterol and therefore heart health. Another thing which I was surprised about, or just maybe don't necessarily is being linked to thyroid health straight away, is gastric health or gastric emptying. So perhaps people being more constipated or you know, frequent, like in inconsistent stools, etc. Maybe you can explain that as well.
Yeah, so the thyroid hormones will stimulate gastric motility, so essentially just the moving of foods through your gastrointestinal tract. It does this by essentially causing the muscles within your gastrointestinal tract, specifically the small intestine, to contract and relax. And this increases the speed at which food moves through your intestinal tract and the rate at which you empty your gastrointestinal tract. So in hyperthyroidism, one thing that we see a lot of times is nutrient deficiencies caused by malabsorption. We do also see an increased usage of these micronutrients just because their metabolic rate is running so high, but they also have a decrease in their absorption because if food moves too quickly throughout your gastrointestinal tract, you simply are not providing your body with enough time to actually absorb all of the nutrients. We also see that these people typically come with diarrhea, oftentimes feeling of excessive hunger because one of the signals to stop you from eating is just having food in your intestinal tract. So this excessive hunger just comes as a result of food going in and out quite rapidly. So you're essentially ready for that next sooner. And conversely, with hypothyroidism, we see a lot of constipation issues. A lot of times these people don't feel hungry. So that's another thing that if you're not very hungry, that could be a sign of having a lower thyroid, just because as most people may know, when you have a lot of food in your stomach, you're not really hungry for more food. You're not ready to put more food in your stomach. So that's another thing that we see with hypothyroidism is a low appetite, but also still with a degree of weight gain or not being able to lose weight. So there's a lot of factors that go into weight maintenance despite still not being very hungry, but also constipation. So, and again, there's like a spectrum for things. So you can have pretty severe hypothyroidism, pretty severe hyperthyroidism, or you can be on this spectrum in the middle. So having a lot of these markers together and having some degree of constipation might indicate a lower than normal thyroid, but not to the point where we might consider thyroid replacement.
Yeah, I think amongst our listeners are probably more the people that have a lower functioning thyroid slash suffer from constipation, at least from like in general speaking. So yeah, I think later on when we get more into the pointers of like how can we kind of boost our thyroid health and maybe increase that production of TSH or then later on T3, T4, that'll be super interesting. But before we do that, you mentioned a term in your paper titled the negative feedback loop. What is that?
Yeah, so this one's actually quite important as to why we use TSH as a blood marker to diagnose thyroid disorders. So the active thyroid hormones, T3, has the capacity to essentially bind to the pituitary gland and inhibit it from producing more of the T4 and T3. Most hormonal systems in the body have this regulatory effect. So if we think about testosterone, testosterone can be converted into estrogen, and estrogen has the ability to actually inhibit the brain from producing more GnRH, which is the initial hormone similar to TRH that instigates the process of steroidogenesis. So when we see that someone has very high TSH, this is an indication that they have low circulating levels of T3, so there's not much of a negative feedback inhibition to reduce their production of TSH. because this TSH will subsequently go to the thyroid and continue to stimulate it to produce T3. But if we have very low TSH, that's a very common indicator of hyperthyroidism, because there is so much T3 in circulation and so much negative inhibition of TSH production that we see essentially that pituitary gland, depending on how severe it is, can actually begin to atrophy, and because it's simply just not being stimulated. But we also see that it's just not producing much TSH. There does appear to be some regulation within the brain as well, so regulating the synthesis of TRH, and this can be done by either TSH or T3. So that one's interesting. TSH also has a feedback loop. There are some very, very minor functions of TSH in the body that it's still not fully clear all the things that it does, but it does appear to have a little bit of an effect within the brain to reduce the production of TRH.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, and you did lay out quite nicely what markers would be great to test for. So you already said TSH, T3, T4, reverse T3. But then you also mentioned, of course, if you are not having blood markers taken super regularly, perhaps financial reasons or whatever, body temperature can actually be somewhat indicative too. And I think, some women take their body temperature regularly anyway because of like cycle tracking, etc. So nonetheless, what would be an indication just by body temperature that there is something wrong?
Yeah, so this was something I struggled with writing the article, was I couldn't find a good body temperature cutoff. There just wasn't one that's really been tested much. But one thing that we can look at is simply just taking your body temperature as it is right now, seeing the average body temperature of most people and seeing if you're above or below that. And then for the most part, just tracking it over time. So if your body temperature is consistently decreasing, and you're seeing symptoms of, you know, have like a lot of the other symptoms of hypothyroidism, then it could be an indication that you might want to actually have a test done, just a one-time test to, if you can afford it. Or if you gradually see your body temperature rising, and this is specifically body temperature in the morning upon awakening, that appears to be the most accurate. But just taking this body temperature and seeing where it's at, whether it's high, low, and whether or not it's increasing or decreasing, can give us an indication of where our thyroid levels are at. A lot of times I feel that it's better to use body temperature as an indication once you're already on some sort of protocol to help increase your thyroid production or some sort of thyroid hormones, just to kind of measure without having to continue to get more and more blood work to see how it's actually affecting your thyroid production. Because if you see your body temperature gradually rising throughout the month or year, while you're simultaneously maybe increasing your iodine intake or taking some sort of thyroid replacement therapy, if you see it, that's an indication that it's beginning to work. And if you don't see any change in body temperature or resolution in symptoms, that might be an indication that there's something else going on, or you're simply just not on the right protocol.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And of course, I would say when monitoring that, it's probably useful going over several months, especially for females, just because obviously after ovulation or, you know, during our period cycle, the temperature would be different. But yeah, if we take like an average and then monitor it, that could still be helpful. But yeah, in your article, what I loved so much at the end also was just some helpful takeaways. And I think we're always big on the application, on like, what does that actually mean for us today now? So you already mentioned a few very helpful micronutrients, but maybe you can go through that list again of like what you would do and what are the main things we can do in order to optimize our thyroid.
Yeah, so I wish I had the article with me so I could remember everything, but I definitely, just micronutrients in general, it appears like there are major micronutrients, but most micronutrients affect the thyroid in some way. So we're thinking of things like the B vitamins, zinc, antioxidants especially, but focusing, our main focus of attention would be on zinc, iodine and selenium, as well as, you know, if for some reason you're consuming a very low protein diet and you're not consuming enough tyrosine, or you're consuming enough protein but you're malabsorbing a lot of that protein, so indicating you might have some issues with either stomach acid or just simply malabsorption issues. that could also be a, you know, a factor in thyroid production. And then even just kind of increasing our tyrosine intake and seeing if that makes any difference can also be helpful. And then a lot of the thyroid hormone is stimulated by lifestyle factors, not necessarily dietarily. So obviously there are the micronutrients that we need to have there in the first place. But then the signal that you're receiving from your brain to actually, whether or not it actually wants the thyroid hormone, is in large part under the control of your lifestyle. So poor sleep, things like poor sleep, and bad lifestyle habits do appear to have a deleterious effect on the thyroid, specifically body weight. So when we're at too low of a body weight, that will decrease our production of thyroid hormone, especially being in a caloric deficit. This is kind of just due to the hormonal milieu that comes alongside either losing weight or just being chronically underfed that can decrease our production of the thyroid hormone. But we also see that excessive body weight has the same effect. It's likely due to a few different factors that actually have to do with some of your cells becoming resistant to specific molecules such as insulin or leptin, such that it's almost like even though you have a lot of body fat and you should have the signal to burn more body fat, eat less food, there's kind of like a disruption in the signaling cascade. So you might be producing a lot of leptin from your fat tissue or producing a lot of insulin, but your brain really isn't registering it and sending out that initial signal to increase metabolic expenditure, decrease hunger, things like that. So kind of like essentially everything, staying at a moderate body weight is probably the best for maintaining adequate thyroid function. And then we also see that like excessive physical activity, so doing so much exercise that you get into what can be referred to as overtraining, or in sports it's called REDS, so relative energy deficiency in sports. So just getting to a point where you're training so much and you're not consuming enough food to essentially replenish and recover, or not providing yourself enough time to recover, that can also have an inhibitory effect on the thyroid production, mainly through the action of things like cortisol, as well as the other catecholamines. But it's kind of making sure that you have enough time to recover, but you're not doing too little that, you know, you end up excessively overweight. But one thing that is kind of debated as to whether or not we can actually overtrain or we can simply just not recover by eating enough food or by not sleeping enough. So let's say you're someone that just loves exercise. Maybe it's just the feeling, the people that you're with, things like that. Just focusing all your efforts on recovery, maybe trying to reduce the intensity of your exercise, things like that. But for most people, in all honesty, they don't have to worry about overtraining. Most people just don't get to that point. But a lot of people do have to think about underfueling, so not eating enough to help with the demands of exercise. Or again, overfeeding can also be inhibitory for thyroid production.
Yeah, the thing that I'll throw in there as well is, even though like I 100% agree with everything you said, I would just say that a lot of people, even though they might not be overtraining per se, or perhaps even eating the right amount of food, adding lifestyle stress in there that or having the lifestyle stress that they're not addressing. So your training volume might be quote unquote optimal hypothetically if all you had to do for the rest of the day was sit, relax, and get a massage, perhaps. But I don't know anybody where that is the case. And I think we often underestimate how impactful that kind of stress is also. And then we do all these kind of things like foam rolling and going to the sauna and what, because we think, oh, we need to help our training adapt to the or our body adapt to the training stress, but we don't do anything to mitigate for emotional stress, work stress, whatever stress it might be. So yeah, that's just one thing I wanted to mention too. And then one other question, or actually two more that I had, was in regards to the dieting. And you also mentioned specifically that low carb diets in particular could be more of or could lead more to thyroid, like in a deficit, let's just say protein being equal or whatever. But if it's a low carb diet, that particularly could affect the thyroid more. And maybe you can touch on that for a second.
Yeah, so it's fairly, underspoken that insulin has effects, as we've talked about in the last podcast, has effects everywhere. And one thing it does is it is permissive to thyroid production. So in a very low insulin state, so chronically, I guess with a chronic deficiency in insulin signaling, people can kind of run into a lot of problems on a very low carbohydrate diet for prolonged periods of time. Essentially, as much as this argument is not always correct, but we just simply didn't adapt or evolve on chronically being underfed on carbohydrates. So having a periodic burst of carbohydrates in and out of ketosis that can be helpful for those who do enjoy a low carbohydrate diet. But insulin has a permissive effect on thyroid production. So in a very low carbohydrate diet, because of this lack of insulin signaling, we do see a bit steeper of a decrease in thyroid production. And there may be some other factors that come into play, but it's not a subject that has really been looked at very much depth. But we do also see, I've spoken to a few people on the internet who have done long-term ketogenic diets for a while. And some of the more popular ones also see that they do see lower T3 than the average person. Sometimes there's not a concomitant increase in TSH, which could possibly indicate an improved sensitivity to the thyroid hormones or simply just a decreased need for the thyroid hormones. But a lot of times people on a very low carbohydrate diet see a concomitant increase in TSH and decrease in T3. And that is probably the most accurate indicator of lower thyroid production, and just an indicator that whatever you're doing at the moment is deleteriously impacting your thyroid health. So in like a caloric deficit in general will certainly decrease thyroid production, but chronically restricting carbohydrates kind of has a secondary hormonal milieu that will decrease it a little bit further, it appears like.
Yeah, I think that that's a really important point, actually, because I mean, calorie deficit is one thing, but then, I think especially with current trends, et cetera, it might be popular to just give that a try without even thinking about it for, a little bit longer. Very last question. I do want to honor your time, but you mentioned heavy metals in there as well affecting thyroid health negatively. To your knowledge, or what would you recommend? People to do in order to minimize heavy metal exposure.
Oh yeah. So one heavy metal that most people don't think about is iron. If you have underlying issues such as hemochromatosis, where you excessively absorb iron, understanding that and knowing that is actually extremely important because this iron can have deleterious effects throughout the entire body, especially in the thyroid gland. So having iron is very tricky because having too low of iron is definitely deleterious, but also having too high of iron is also deleterious. So kind of finding that Goldilocks zone, not too much, not too little. So kind of under knowing where your iron status is at, and how it's affected for most individuals, let's say premenopausal individuals who are menstruating monthly, those people don't typically have to worry about excess iron. But if let's say you maintain the same iron intake and iron replacement in postmenopause as you did in premenopause, just because you're not menstruating on a monthly basis, you'll definitely see you're going to be much more at risk of having excessive iron. So understanding the differences in iron loss between the phases of the menstrual cycle is super important. And then heavy metals, the most common ones are going to be things like lead and mercury. And essentially, the best thing that we can do to combat heavy metals is, well, it's twofold. As most people would expect, just trying to avoid them whenever we can. So, supplements is a weird place that sometimes we run into heavy metal exposure. So, having third-party tested supplements or just trying to minimize your consumption of supplements in general. Other places is fish. So, consuming extremely large fish, such as swordfish or sark, that's where you'll be kind of presented with the largest amount of heavy metals. So, one thing I like is called the SMASH diet. Sardines, mackerel, anchovies, salmon, and herring. So just essentially the smallest, lowest heavy metal fish that you can find. If you like, I love seafood. Seafood's fantastic. But trying to consume more low heavy metal fish, whether or not you have the capacity to avoid things that are essentially brought to you in metal, can also be helpful. But And that's not always feasible. So focusing on the other bigger rocks is also, is probably going to be a better step. Washing fruits and vegetables before you consume them could be helpful. And then micronutrients are extremely helpful for essentially combating heavy metal exposure. So probably the easiest one is selenium. So selenium, while it also helps the thyroid function, it's probably the main micronutrient involved in mercury detoxification. So it can help turn mercury into a less toxic, less detrimental form. It can also essentially bind to mercury, almost acting like a mercury magnet, allowing us to safely excrete it. And then the other thing that it can do is it's a very important, it is the one of the main components in what are called selenoproteins, which are essentially like detoxifying proteins found within the liver. It can help detoxify numerous toxicants, including mercury. So selenium is crazy helpful for getting rid of mercury. And then we see that in a state of nutrient deficiencies, we typically have an increased absorption for micronutrients. So let's say you're deficient in calcium. After consuming a bolus of calcium, you will absorb more calcium than you would have if you had adequate calcium levels. But one thing that is that heavy metals use the same transporters as micronutrients to cross from the intestinal tract into the bloodstream. So if I'm not mistaken, lead uses the calcium transporter within the gastrointestinal tract. So essentially, that's how we absorb lead, is through the calcium transporter. So in a state of deficiency of micronutrients, we are so much more, that we have so many more of those transporters, and they're so much more sensitive to uptaking nutrients, we have an increased risk of absorbing the heavy metals we're exposed to in a state of a micronutrient deficiency. And the other thing is that even in a state of adequacy, if we're consuming high amounts of micronutrients alongside high amounts of heavy metals, or alongside a meal that contains heavy metals, they will essentially compete for absorption and will absorb less of the heavy metals and of the micronutrients. But if they're essentially provided without competition, we're much more likely to absorb them because they're not being opposed by micronutrients.
Super, super interesting. Calvin, thank you so much. You explained everything so nicely. And I also just love the practical takeaways that you've given us. Of course, I will link once again all your social media handles, but maybe you just want to shout out your IG and your TikTok, since you put out so much good information on there as well, debunking a lot of stuff. So, yes.
Yeah, so essentially, if you look up my name, Calvin Scheller, anywhere, you should find me. I believe on Instagram, it's Calvin_Scheller. And on TikTok, it would be Physiology with Calvin. I'm running into a weird issue today, or the last 2 days, is something happened. I'm not quite sure what it was, but one of my videos got flagged. And then my 5 or 6 most recent videos have about, you know, 1/10, 1/100th of the views they normally have. So I'll have to get that one sorted out, but I'll definitely be reposting everything on Instagram, just in case you can't find it or something happens. I'm not sure yet. And then for YouTube, I believe it's just Calvin Scheller, maybe Calvin Scheller 6. And then my website would just be calvinscoaching.com. You can go to my website, read some articles that I have on there. You can reach out to me on the website, sign up for coaching on the website, but your most direct access to me would just be sending me a DM. I respond to essentially everything I can. So just send me a DM on Instagram, on TikTok, anything really.
Awesome. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, or share the episode on social. Very much appreciated. You can also follow us on Instagram at Nutrition Coaching and Life, or head to our website, www.nutritioncoachingandlife.com, where we provide more valuable content. Have a wonderful day. Now go out and work on your best self.